Hello, everybody. Good evening. We'll start with our motivation. So I'm sitting here thinking about this evening. I've been really grateful, I guess would be the word, for the opportunity to have had Venerable Children teach this particular text. I think I never thought that we'd actually get to the place where we could understand this. So I'm happy that we've been able to receive these teachings and that we're actually managing these questions pretty well most of the time. So it's quite an amazing opportunity. So for anyone here in the room and anyone who has been listening to these teachings, it's really unusual to have this depth presented. It's quite clear that even when Geshe Thapke was here, and he's such a fantastic and knowledgeable teacher, there is so little time that he can't take the time that Venerable has been able to share with us and give us really full explanations and explain things multiple times so that they can kind of sink in. And so may we really feel a sense of joy in our opportunity, knowing that whatever understandings that we have will only grow over time if we keep at it and keep trying to ask our questions and understand and come back to the ideas and think about them and then eventually meditate on them. So just taking a moment to celebrate this. It's as we've been saying a lot lately around here, the news is pretty dark, pretty disturbing in general. A lot of things going on in the world, and so it's very important to put our mind on something that is also going well, because there's many, many things going well that we never get to hear about. So, and then may we have the opportunity to really take these teachings to heart and get to the place where we can understand them and penetrate the meaning. May we follow this path all the way to full awakening, keeping in our hearts the suffering of the world, the suffering of all various beings, and the wish to alleviate that suffering. So may that be our motivation. So we're on chapter 10 still on the quiz. This is the second quiz. And we may even get into the third quiz tonight. Last week a question came about the Zigpa. And the person who asked the question was then wrote in or something. I can't remember the order of it all, but it is a non-affirming negation. And chapter 11 goes into that. And so that will be talked about then. So that's just the errata, with the word. I haven't studied it yet to figure out how that could be, so I won't say anything more, but maybe by next week I will have studied it. I couldn't really move my mind into the next chapter until I finished tonight. So we're on question number 10. So that was, how do you refute the idea of one cosmic mind, that we emerge from a conception and dissolve into a death? Anybody managed to refute that, or is that really how it happened? That's it. Oh, yeah. That takes care of everything. I mean, now we know where we're going.
Well, I didn't get very far, at least the second part of the question, but my thinking is from what I've been hearing in the teachings is if that were true, it would assert that all beings arise from this one cosmic mind, which means that all of us would be exactly the same as that one cosmic mind, be identical in all aspects of it. And since the cosmic mind is unchanging, there's no way we would go through our entire life changing by moment as impermanent phenomena and then dissolve back into something that's permanent. I mean,
yeah, so here we are. If we all came from one cosmic mind, which is a permanent mind, then first off, we'd all be identical. You'd be coming out of something that was permanent, which is impossible, and dissolving back into something that is permanent, which is also impossible. We'd all be the same. We wouldn't change throughout our lives. It'd be like a bunch of stamped, you know, everybody not able to do anything. Yeah. Did other people have ideas? I had. Yeah.
And then while going on, if you say, okay, that's true.
Okay, if you say it's true.
That's true, but it's impermanent. It's fluid.
Yeah.
Everything arises out of it in a fluid way.
Yeah, it's not a permanent cosmic mind, it's an impermanent, fluid cosmic mind.
Then you have to ask, well, then it was a cause phenomenon.
So, yeah.
Where did it come from?
Yeah, where did it
come from? Causes.
Yeah. Yeah. What are the causes of the cosmic mind? That's where I had trouble too. Like, how could you posit a beginning to a mind stream even? How does it what? And how does it create? Yeah, if it's permanent, that would be tough. And how does a mind create? Is that what you're saying? How does a mind create, or how does a permanent mind create?
Just the substance.
Oh, the substance. Yeah, there were different views that came up in this. It was interesting to go through the various questions that related to this, because we have kind of elements of it both in the nowadays and different ideas and in the past. The one thing that Venable spoke about is how in the Samkhya tradition they had, remember, their 25 elements. One of them was the person that was impermanent, and the other 24 were permanent. But the one that everything came out of was this principle or universal substance out of which everything is created. And so it was, she was saying, this is a lot like things in the New Age kind of ideas too. So there's some kind of universal oneness of everything, and that everything is created out of that, kind of what you're saying there, like how could that be? And how nice it sounds, you know. But this permanent substance that's never changed isn't always there. You know, we appear out of it and we go absorb back into it, but if it's permanent, that's completely impossible. So that's your point, I think. How could a substance work like that? So that was one idea that had come about from the Samkhyas. And then there was another one, from the Nayayikas. And theirs was more like there's a small part. How do they say, merely a small part with mind that is conscious. So they kind of saw the body or the person as vast as space. So again, there was this idea of a permanent person that was extensive like space. But that one wasn't a conscious entity. But still, it's another one of these ideas of like, I am one with everything. And then there was another school that believed in a permanent omnipresent self. So then if the self is in everyone, then how could you tell the difference between me and you? Because we're all like the same person then. There's one unified I that everyone's one with, and it's partless. I mean, the whole thing, when you think about it, it actually can't function or work. But, you know, it's funny how those ideas have come up. So if those things went the way like we're saying there, if we're all identical, we'd all be the same, then I would like somebody else's bank account. One with more zeros before the dot. I don't care. Just a lot of zeros before the dot, and it doesn't matter. And then the thing I was kind of having trouble with this one is this one point she just spoke on briefly, but how does matter create consciousness? You know, that's one thing that happens with the Samkhya thing, because the Samkhya are saying that everything evolves out of this matter. But then, you know, and it's the same kind of thing with the scientific view, too. The brain of matter is the mind, the person. And that's pretty hard for me to see how you get a... If you really think about it, how, if you just go the science route, since we know a little bit about anatomy, how do you get the clear and knowing nature from, like, dopamine? Or from you know, like nerve tissue, or from that glob of, you know, from your cerebral spinal fluid. Well, nobody thinks it's that anyway. That's just the, you know, but, you know, all that massive electrical activity, how does that become something clear and knowing? That's beyond me. That's why I believe the mind is formless, because it's hard to fathom how that could ever work. Of course, they do have ideas about that. Emergent property, I think, is the one that
whatever that is.
Yeah, this is undefined. But I found it recently. I found a source for that, actually. It being an emergent property. Yeah, it's a book from the mid-80s, but it's out of print, so I couldn't find it anymore. So basically, we have this comfortable but impossible idea that's around these days and was around in ancient times. Comfortable. Did anyone else have any other ideas that went with this one? That kind of. I think that did it for me. Okay, so we'll go on to number 11. Okay, this is one really asking us for our subjective experience. So even people who haven't studied this text, you can answer this question. There's a feeling that you are inside of your body. You know that feeling. On what basis do you feel that? Is there a you inside of your body? If there is, where is it? And if there isn't, whose body is it? This is a really good question to answer if you don't even haven't read one word of this text. You should ask yourself these questions. Okay, so there's a feeling that you are inside of your body. And why do you feel that? What's the basis for you feeling that?
Things come up mm-hmm. that I feel in my body and mind, and then grasp on those and makes it more than it really is. There's not a valuable person there. All this stuff is associated. I call that, but it's not mine in the same way, you know, like my socks aren't mine. I'm maybe using it at the moment. You know, it's associated with me, but I don't own them. They're not me. You know?
Mm-hmm. But your body is me.
Feels
yeah. Okay, so if I can repeat this a little bit. So you're saying that there's like this ignorance that is like apprehending things this way. It thinks there's a real me inside of this body and mind that you live with all the time. But there's still, you can make this distinction of like your socks, you might call them mine, but they're not really mine in the sense of like my arm is mine, my eyes are mine, or, you know, that kind of distinction that we would make. So that's pointing to this ignorance that grasps things that way.
And especially because even sometimes the socks feel like they're mine.
Right. Sometimes the socks feel like they're mine, like nobody else better mess with them and don't put holes in them and don't wash them wrong so they shrink.
I perceive this world through this body, not through my socks. I perceive through my eyes, my ears, my
right.
When I look out at things, I feel like I'm looking out from behind my eyes.
Yeah.
From behind my ears.
Yeah, that's your experience. All of our sense organs are looking out, and I'm back there experiencing it all.
It's palpable.
Yeah, it's palpable.
I've had these experiences where I'm driving down the road, and I'm looking, watching the drive. There's this driving, and there is somebody in there watching that happening.
Yeah,
that somebody's in charge that isn't holding the wheels, kind of directing the show, is looking down the road, has the lights on, and there is somebody in there.
Okay, so here you've got yourself doing something like driving a car, and you've got another, you know, a person, the real kingpin,
yep.
Watching the whole show go on. That's, yeah, the controller.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's the felt experience.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, is there a you inside of your body?
Seems so.
Seems so.
You bet.
You bet. Okay. Okay, if there is, where is it?
In the socks.
In the socks. Yeah. Come on, where is it, you guys? All you that want to say yes? How many yays?
It permeates.
It permeates the whole thing.
It permeates the whole body. It permeates the whole mind.
Okay, so if it's permeating your whole body and mind, and I cut off your hand, now are there two of you?
Gosh. No.
How about Van Gogh? He lost an ear. Now there's two of them?
No. It's continuous. The reason would be one minus hand. You have to dismantle.
Yeah.
Until Semke ceases.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly. It's exactly like the time Venerable Children did it with a flower. You've got, like, you have, let's do it with a flower. It's not so gross. Okay, you've got a flower, a daisy, and you start pulling off the petals. At what point does it quit being a flower? Two petals? I think I had needs a few more, maybe.
More than four.
Two-thirds? No, two-thirds, it's still a flower. You know. So it's just like, and she's saying with her body, it feels, it'd be like that. Yeah, there's all these funny consequences. Yeah, I know, that's the problem with that. You take them all apart, the whole flower, you throw it all over the table. Hey, if you're your whole body and all the parts, and we take your parts and we spread them all over the room, we still got all the parts. Are you still there?
They have to be connected.
Well, they have to be connected.
In a particular order. And functioning.
Yeah. But where is it? Hey, it's in the room.
Wherever I am.
It's wherever you are. Okay, let's go the other way. If there isn't a you inside of there, then whose body is it?
Mine. It's mine.
It's mine. Okay. So do you get some sense that we've kind of fabricated this sense of self? Do you get any sense of that when you think about this long enough? Or no, it's just so much there. But when you search and search and search and you can never find it, like, I mean, toss off all your parts one at a time. Throw them in a heap next to you. Like, just start with the skin. Okay, take all your skin, toss it over there. Take all your muscles, toss them over there. Take all your nerves, toss them over there. You still get your bones. Okay, we'll leave the bones for a while. Take all your internal organs, toss them over there. You can do them one at a time. Well, let's do them all at once. Your toenails, your eyeballs. What's left? Your lymph system.
Very special.
All the fluids in your body.
Light essence.
Your bone marrow. Okay, now that's the skeleton.
My mind.
Your mind. Oh, your mind is you. Where is it?
Here somewhere.
Isn't that pile of rubbish over there? Okay, it's as existent as sky flowers. That's what she says.
I feel sky flowers, and I feel me.
Yeah, you do feel you. It's a conception, my friend.
I'm not scary.
It's hard to think of ourselves that the self is a conception.
Yeah.
That's hard.
And to think that, to really think that it's something that feels so real.
Yeah.
Logically, you can really go there. It is a conception,
but how can it be so real? Right.
That's what's scary.
Yeah, that is hard. But when you really quiet your mind, it helps to unravel that a little bit. When you keep not being able to find it, just the not finding, you know, when you really do this slowly and have a lot of time. I don't know, I think it's pretty hard to think of ourselves this way. It's really hard to get outside of, I'm here, I'm talking.
Because we are. I mean, that's what makes it hard.
That's the ignorance. Yeah. That's how active our ignorance is.
But also because
we're functioning.
In the false truth angle, that's exactly who it is that's here. It's me.
So. Yeah, that merely existing thing.
Yeah. Like if it were all or nothing, that would be easier. Yeah, but it's not.
Mixed up together.
Yeah. Yeah, everything's mishmashed together. Well, we weren't the only ones who had this problem.
It's a comfort.
Yeah. It feels very permanent is the problem. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. Every time you think of that self, it feels very permanent, it feels very frozen, it feels very static, and none of that can actually work. And that's very, that we've convinced ourselves of, I think, quite well here. So this is, there's, in the text, they start, they do this one verse that has this general refutation, and it just kind of goes through all the various ideas, like some of the Sāmkhyas and Vaisheshikas, they thought the body, the self existed in everybody, as ubiquitous as space, and then the Jains, who are the Narganthas, they saw that the self is proportionate to the size of the body, so it was as big as an ant if you were an ant, or as big as an elephant if you were an elephant. Then another group thought that, no, it's just this small little part, you know, and so they had all these different ideas. But if the self existed, and we're so convinced about it, then why are there so many assertions about what it is? Why are there so many assertions? That's a good point right there. Like that mm-hmm. to me, that makes a lot of sense. And so the verse that this is from is verse 243. Some see it as ubiquitous, and for some the person is the mere size of the body. Some see it as a mere particle. The wise see it as non-existent. So here's the solution to our dilemma. This self exists merely by being labeled. It exists only in name and labeling and concept. And what we have a hard time wrapping our mind around is how subtle labeling and concept is. We think of it as like the label on this Kleenex box, you know, when we talk about labeling, but labeling doesn't even need words. I mean, pre-verbally, you're labeling things, you know. And so labeling is a very subtle thing. So conventionally, there is a self. I walk, I talk, I create actions, I experience results. On the conventional level, all of this works, and we all know what we're talking about. We all know what we're conceiving. That's kind of important, I think. But then you try to investigate, where is it? You can go through this, you'll never find it. When you try to find out exactly who you are, what do you point to? What can you draw a circle around? Say, this is me. You can't. It's that self that you're seeing there, that we're experiencing, is totally non-existent. But there is a self in a person that functions and does things. But you can't say there's a truly existent objective thing. That's the essence of me-ness. But that is how it feels. You know, it's totally how it feels. So we have to become very aware of that. And especially when it looms large. We're in trouble then. We're usually somebody's doing something we don't like. And there's the object of negation.
Far it's too late.
Yeah, but it helps. So, yeah, but you can go back to it. Maybe you can't catch it right then, but when you sit down on the cushion, you can go back and you can remember that experience. Wrongly accused is really always, whenever you're wrongly accused, the sense of self just pops up. No, no problem. And this is kind of the, you know, this problem that we're having is the problem that a lot of these other schools had, because in fact, the ones that wanted something to be permanent is because they needed a continuity. They needed something to hold everything together. If there wasn't this me, what was holding everything together? Because I am me, I'm not you, right? So if we're just a bunch of atoms and molecules and parts and labels, and it's like, well, we could be able to interchange a few parts here.
Also, it's have been, always will be.
Oh, yeah, have been, always will be. Yeah, the feeling of permanence. Yeah, that definitely feels like that, even though you watch your body and mind. Although I have to say, from doing that meditation on rebirth, when you look at the previous moment of your mind, I get a sense that of this, it lightens up for me, this whole sense, because I do it at 5-year intervals, and I've done it many, many times, and I have to say sometimes I don't feel like that self of the 5-year-old or the 10-year-old or the 15-year-old. I really, but I have to be really in a quiet space, and you know, I work my way back, and then I just say, yeah, I don't, what would be the same about this me right now and that one back there? It feels much less solid to me than that meditation I find helpful for this. So, but the reality is that there's some kind of something is not matching up between the way things appear to us and how they actually exist. And so what Venable said around this time was, we don't really get this, but I don't think, I don't really get this to the full meaning, but it's good for us to hear it again. The way one of our teachers expects it is this: there's a table in the room, but there's no table on the basis of designation. There's a table in the room, right?
Yeah.
But there's no table on this basis of designation. You, in all of these parts here, you won't find a table. All you'll find is a bunch of parts. And you can keep breaking those down, just like Shanti Deva does with the body. You keep breaking down all the parts. And then I thought there was a really good question asked where, like, I didn't write out all of it, but I think Venerable Jigme asked this, or Venerable Children was talking about the glue is basically our conceptual mind. We put all these parts together and give it a name. And then we forget that we've done this, and we think that it's it from its own side. Well, that's a little easier to do with this phone, because they're so fancy now, and they're like, you know, this is definitely a speaker phone, a digital speaker phone. But, you know, it's actually just a phone. Always been a phone. You know, we can go back and forth with some things as they're new and fancier. But, you know, like that, well, that's just a gong. It's always been a gong. We forget we label it, you know. So we can kind of see that. And then Venerable Jigme asks, well, what's the glue? Is it our identities or our habits or our memories? And Venerable Children said, no, the habits and the memories would be part of the base. The glue is just the conceptual mind of I am. I. That's the thing that's doing this conceptual mind of I am.
The glue meaning the grasping that's trying to hang together.
She didn't define it any more than that. Okay. And then the other big point of this, which we've touched on just a little bit, is how much we suffer because we fabricate an I that in reality doesn't exist. That part I think most of us here have some sense of from our practices. We can see, for instance, when we're in a really strong negative emotion, for example, how much that is fabricated. And the sense of I is very strong then. And it's easy to see how the anger has really exaggerated things. Not maybe right when you're in it, but later on you can look back, hindsight's 20/20 and all that kind of stuff. Everyone has that experience. So if you can look at those moments and see how you're seeing yourself then, you can start, I think, to get a sense of how much you're fabricating that person that you're trying to protect that you can never find. You know, I mean, this is the root of our suffering, friends. Okay, number 12. If the self exists at the time of liberation, why do you say there's no self when you're in samsara? If the self doesn't exist at the time of liberation, who attains liberation? You get the question? If the self exists at the time of liberation, why do you say there's no self when you're in samsara? And if the self doesn't exist at the time of liberation, who attains liberation? Kind of a problem.
Seems like a question for the Buddha.
Actually, no, we're going to answer this and you'll get it. It's not that hard. Anyone want to say anything?
Well, it's funny. I have verse 245, June 5th, 50 minutes or so.
Yeah.
Let's see, let's see if I got anything out of it or if I just made that note. Oh, that was a question for myself.
Okay.
Well,
what is liberation in this view.
Oh, what is liberation?
What actually is liberation?
Oh, in this question, liberation is the nirvana that we know of. It is the liberation that we're speaking of. So here's what happened with this one. Okay, and we already showed in verse 244 that the whole idea of liberation would be like ridiculous, meaningless if there was a permanent self. We did that in the past, so I'm not going to redo that. But basically, the idea was how can something that's permanent, like a permanent self, be harmed or unharmed? You know, you're not really creating any karma. You're never going to suffer. Or you're always going to suffer, you know, but you're not changing. So we already kind of said liberation is irrelevant for one whose self is permanent. We did that in the past. Then it goes on to the next one is this thing of like asserting that the existence of a self during liberation is really inappropriate. And why is that? Well, because to get liberated, you have to realize selflessness. So if you're realizing selflessness, but there's a self, then that doesn't work either. Either liberation isn't feasible, or because and liberation wouldn't be feasible then, because if you can't get rid of the self, then you don't have the solution or the antidote to get to liberation. Because the solution is the realization of selflessness. So if you've still got a self there, if you're keeping the self there, you're going to never have the medicine to get liberated. You see what I'm saying? Right. I'm trying to not go into this.
Which is not giving up the self.
No, you haven't. Say that. Which is not giving up the self.
I mean.
Well, no, you're not giving up the self.
You're not giving up the self to be liberated.
Yeah, that's the point of this verse. It would be inappropriate. It just doesn't, they don't match.
Right.
So here's how Venerable explained it. She said, if the self exists, like in samsara, then it's inappropriate to think that there's no self. Or if there's a self that exists in liberation, then it's inappropriate to think that there's no self in samsara. It's kind of got to be one or the other. Either there's no self or there is a self. And then, and also, how could somebody claim they ever got to nirvana if they didn't get rid of the self? Because the cause of getting to nirvana is realizing selflessness.
It's not that you don't want to get rid of the self, but that you realize it's not there.
What's the difference between realizing a self isn't there and
getting rid of the self?
Okay.
So if we say that at nirvana or at liberation we're getting rid of the self, then we're assuming that there was one and somehow we get free from having one,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to realizing there never was one.
Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah, that the conception is completely in error. It's non-existent.
Right. Opposed to, I'm going to get rid of this ego.
Well,
get
rid of the idea of a self would be better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Free of the misconception.
Free of the misconception, right. Okay, so that's what that verse does. And then the next one... is really more what the question is about. So, but what happened is, fearing that this absurd consequence that there could be a conception of a self and then it went away or something, you know, how that didn't work, what they came up with something else, which was like, okay, well, there's not a self in samsara, but there is a self in nirvana. That was kind of the idea. Because, see, if you'd have these conceptions of a self that occurred in the liberated state, if the self exists, one might assert that there's no self, but there's a truly liberated, truly existent liberated self. Here's how the verse went. If it exists at liberation, it should not be non-existent before. It is explained that what is seen without anything is its nature. That doesn't help. Okay, let's try it this way. Okay, so they're saying, this is how Venerable reworded it. Okay, so they're saying there's no self, but there's a truly existent liberated person. Okay, so if there's a truly existent liberated person in enlightenment, then there has to be, or in liberation, then there must be a truly existent objective individual in samsara, because that self has this entity that's independent from all other factors. You can't go from something that's like unchanging has its own nature that's not dependent on any other factors and cause it. You can't produce that from something that's, you know, different, so different from that. So that doesn't work at all. So make up your mind already, is what she said. So they have the whole notion of the self is incorrect. And basically, yeah, the entity, that's the I think the crux of it, that why, the reasoning why it can't work, because that independent, objective self that would exist at the time of liberation doesn't have any, it's independent from what would lead to it. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't even need to bother. Either it would never happen or always be again. You're down to the same. And how could something impermanent cause something permanent? That doesn't work either. Okay, so now we're on the last question, which is question 13. And this is to explain verse 250, which says, since functioning things arise, there is no discontinuation. And because they cease, there is no permanence. And so this verse and the ones that lead up to it, starting at 247, are eliminating the fault of annihilation with regard to selflessness. That's what's really the point of it. Okay.
Go for it.
I'll just go for it, because we want to get on to the next quiz tonight. Not really? Okay, well, maybe we should, though. Okay, so in 247, there's kind of like some things that happen in each of these verses that I think were kind of useful. Oops, I just missed a page. No, I didn't. Okay, in 247, what they talked about there that was helpful, I thought, was this idea that we have of like, well, let me read the verse. If the permanent discontinues, how could there be grass at present? If indeed this were true, no one would have ignorance either. And so this is where we're eliminating this fault of thinking that things get annihilated with respect to selflessness. So although there's no self, there's no danger of things getting annihilated and there being nothing there. And that's where our mind goes. We easily fall to, you know, to this kind of view. And it happens because when something is impermanent, those impermanent things are always made of parts, and these things are changing moment by moment, but it comes to seem like it comes to a place where there's like a cliff, a cutoff point. And after that, you get the idea that there's no continuity whatsoever. So is that actually possible for there to be something going along, changing moment by moment, moment by moment, and then just like being at a cliff and a cutoff point, and after that, there's no continuity of what came before it? That's what actually it would have to be happening for things completely discontinued. And so so we have this idea of a continuity of a similar type. So like she used the idea of these kind of tissues. You know, they're changing moment by moment, and from this moment to that moment, whether they're in the same place or not, they're changing moment by moment, but there's something continuing that's similar. But now things aren't always like that, because you could burn one of those up and then that similar type is gone, but you still have the matter is just turned into ash and heat and stuff like that. So there's like a continuity. So, yeah, so we can reach the end of a certain object, and that's how, you know, that happens. Like you burn down a tree or you die, that's the end of that person as they were. Okay, but it's not that the continuity ends. And so this is where this affects us in our actual lives, is there's many people who think that when a person dies, that's the end. They might say, oh yeah, the body decomposes and turns into, you know, compost or whatever. But then the mind, for them, they're saying there's a cliff, there's a cutoff point. So if you really think about that, how would that be possible? How does the clear and knowing nature of the mind, how could it end? If you can't tie it to the body, which I really can't do, just have it be just completely an emergent property of the body, that just, how do you make that happen? Like, where is it in you? Except my brain here, oh, that's Jan, that's Tarpa. No, it doesn't work for me at all. The experiential side of yourself being like a bunch of zapping chemicals, electrical activity, no, the experience is formless. Okay, so if you can buy that it's formless, then when the body ends, how would it end? Things, what ends that you know of that just plain ends without any kind of continuum, even of a dissimilar type? Some things do, I guess you would say, like the permanent objects would, like things that are occasional permanence, like the emptiness of this piece of paper. When I burned this piece of paper up, the emptiness of that piece of paper is gone. That ended.
If you shut off a generator, the continuum of the electricity just ends.
Electrical currents.
I thought about that a bit.
Well, but this potential energy is still there. Like if you think of it like a battery, like you have a battery in a flashlight, you have potential energy.
What if the generator broke?
Doesn't matter. The source of the electricity isn't in the generator. It's coming from a source. The source has got it stored. So it's just like this. The potential energy is there. Whether I let go or not, the potential energy is there for it to fall. It has that kind of potential energy. So it's still there. It's just not. It's in a potential form rather than a. So it's like, just think of it as batteries. That's. When you sometimes your flashlight's on, sometimes it's off. You know, but if you think of more of a battery on a wire, it might work better because you get the idea of the electrical current flowing to the generator. Well, it comes from someplace. It's stored in a potential. Or like the electrical, the water that's behind the dams is potential electrical energy because of what's going to go into. You know, the whole system that goes into that makes it into electricity. So that potential energy is there as long as the water is there. You see what I mean? You're just transforming forms of things. Things are transforming, is that the right word? I think there's a more scientific word for that, but I can't remember what it is.
It's been too long. But when you turn off the gas on the gas stove,
the flame ceases. Yeah, the flame ceases. But the,
and is there any continuity to that flame?
Well, the flame has the flame has ended, but the cause of it, you still have
the flame.
Yeah, the flame. So, well, the heat's gone out.
And the byproduct gases are still existing.
Yeah, the various byproducts of that. You're not creating anymore, but what you had created had transformed, and that's just gone into another phase. I think it's easier to think of like boiling water. Because we know more about that. When you boil the water, it's just going from a liquid phase to a gaseous phase. So when you burn a flame, it's going from one form, which I don't understand as well, to a bunch of gases that you might smell. You know what I mean? So there's not like things, and I don't know enough about physics about how form and matter, you know, they go back and forth too, like two sides of a coin. Do you know what I mean? It's been about 50 years since I 40 years since I had physics.
So what we're talking about is the statement that Vendel made that there's no discontinuation of the causes. The continuum due to the effect arising from the cause through the continuation may not be of a similar type, although the cause. We're talking about how it can change a type, but the causes. There's no discontinuation of the causes.
Sure, cause ceases.
No, causes can cease.
Well, you said something about a similar type. There was a sentence that she had in there. That's what I'm just trying to get.
She said we can reach the end of a certain object. You can reach the end of a certain object. Like there's the discontinuation of this tissue if I burn it up. But there's also, if I don't burn it up, from one moment to another, there's a continuity of this tissue. That's the continuity of a similar type of object. The continuity of a similar type of object. That can end. Did I answer your question?
We can do that in one chapter.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I'm just trying to track this whole thing about the flame and the gas and the generator. We're changing, trying to find out whether things actually discontinue or whether there's a difference in the of a different type that goes into another form. But
there is a continuation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here, we'll keep going, and it gets into it a little bit more. Okay. So what they're trying to point out here that, let's see, maybe back up a little bit. Okay, can the continuity of what composes the tissue ever end? No, because the atoms and molecules keep going. They're changing moment by moment, but there's a continuity of matter and energy interchange. Although she didn't talk about that. And then she said the same thing happens with the mind. Each moment of mind gives rise to a new moment of mind. So there's a continuity, even though each moment of mind ends, like I'm thinking about this, now I'm thinking about that, those end, but there's a continuity between each. If it were the case that something wasn't permanent, that discontinued, then there wouldn't be a continuity. And this is what happens, this is where our minds go when we think that when somebody dies, oftentimes people think there's no continuity of the mind. But is that possible? Is it possible anything that is itself an effect becomes the cause of something else? Okay, and this is where the non-Buddhist systems have trouble, and that's why they posit this permanent self, because they want to kind of hold everything together, or else for them, when the person dies, then the mind stops, everything stops, and there's no continuity whatsoever. Right, this is the view of annihilation. This is the problem that they run into. So that's why they posit this permanent self, because they have to have a continuity. There has to be a continuity, or else their system of thought just falls apart, like who gets liberated and all that kind of stuff. So then, skipped verse 248 because it didn't seem so relevant, but then 249, just a little bit on that. The outline says, producers and that which is produced exists in relation only to impermanent things. This is, I think, interesting. The verse says, just as the sprout, which is a product, is produced from a product, the seed, similarly, all that is impermanent comes from the impermanent. So that answered our one question. So the thing that comes up for me with this is the way I kind of think about things sometimes. Like, even when I think about, I often think about things as a process of, like, change moment to moment in the body. You know, things are changing, your physiology is changing every split second, right? But don't you get the sense when you think of that, like, it's kind of like that kid's toy that flips in from one thing to another, and it freezes for a moment. Freeze, change. It goes like, change, abide. I have that sense of things when I thought about some of this stuff. Like, I usually am thinking about things as a flow, and so things are a process. Things are in constant change. But when I actually look at how my mind thinks about that, sometimes when I actually look at what my thoughts are, these thoughts of permanent come up, and so I have like frozen moments separated by change, frozen moments separated by change, frozen moments separate. That's really actually how I'm finding I think sometimes when I can really look at it. So I wanted to bring that up because that you may find that too. You know, this is it's kind of what it seems like. But that's impossible. Okay, so here herself, Venerable, put this one thing. Each thing that is produced depends on causes and conditions to be produced. Okay, we all accept that. It itself, its nature is that it doesn't exist in the next moment in the same way as it does in this moment. It arises and is different in the next moment. And we'll believe that, except for we have that little split moment in between that one where we don't think that. So it's disintegrated from the moment in which it arose. But there's a continuum to it. It doesn't go out of existence. This is what we're saying here. So it's arising and disintegrating at the same time. And it doesn't have to have that continuum of a similar type, but it could. It just depends on all the other conditions. So now that brings us up to the actual verse, which is verse 250. And this one is trying to show us how permanence an annihilation or avoided in terms of the conventional. That's the outline for this. And the verse again is, since functional things arise, there is no discontinuation. And because they cease, there is no permanence. Okay, so we'll start with the beginning one. Since functional things arise, okay, so you have a sprout that came out of your seed, right? There's no total discontinuation of the seed. The seed is gone, the continuum of the similar type is gone, but still the matter's moved on into another form. So the seed itself ceases, but there's a continuation of the seed. Okay, so things, so because things arise, there's no annihilation, right? So the things do cease, but there's a continuation. And so because things arise, and they don't, and they, that means that you haven't annihilated things. And then, so that's the first two lines. And then the last two lines, because they cease, there's no permanence. So because all of these functioning things cease, they aren't permanent, they aren't static, they don't remain the same. The seed isn't the seed, isn't the seed, isn't the seed. It doesn't go like that. The seed turns into the sprout. So there's no permanence. And she says we easily fall into this. We think when someone dies, they don't exist at all, there's nothingness. That's the annihilation. And there you're having this impermanent thing that just fell off the cliff. You know, you've got rid of the continuation there. And then we go the other route too. We see things that arise, similarly seeing that everything that arises does cease, so nothing arises and then remains static. Yeah, we think things that we think things will just go to permanence. We think things will last forever. That's our happily ever after, like, delusion of, you know, everlasting whatever, everlasting anything. We have a mind that goes that way too, so we go to that extreme too. So these are these two extremes, and that's what they're trying to show, that in conventional, permanence and annihilation can be avoided. So the two extremes here in the conventional, we'll back up a little bit. Oftentimes when we hear about the two extremes, they're talking about the ultimate, and then we're talking about emptiness. So there, the two extremes are inherent existence and total non-existence. But here we're talking the conventional. So the two extremes are permanent, not changing moment by moment, and then annihilation. There not being a continuity after it ceases. So that's the difference there. And so then Nagarjuna wrote this verse that relates to this. Whatever has arisen depending on something is firstly not one with it. It is also not separate from that. And there is no discontinuation and no permanence. So then she broke this apart. So we guess we aren't going into the next quiz tonight. Sorry. It's from Nagarjuna, the Treatise on the Middle Way. So we'll go through the parts of it. Whatever has arisen depending on something is firstly not one with it. So that's talking about any effect that arises from a cause is not inherently one with the cause. That would be impossible. If it were inherently one with the cause wouldn't change. The cause and the effect would be exactly the same, and you wouldn't even need to bother with the whole thing, right? So that's the thing, that a cause and effect can't exist at the same time. They can't be the same thing, or they'd be existing at the same time, and they'd be unnecessary. And if that was the case, then anything could produce an effect, because the cause wouldn't be necessary. That's how anything can produce anything. You wouldn't need that cause, because, you know, they're not related to each other. And you would have just chaos, because anything would produce anything, because you didn't need that cause. And if the cause were still there, even after the effect came into existence, then it would keep producing the thing continuously, right? You just have continual production because the cause is still there. It's there. It's the same as the effect. It's just going, going, going. That'd be nice if it was when the slot machine starts pouring out all the cash, just keep going. Okay, cause and effect can't happen at the same time. And then the next part of it is, it's also not separate from that. So let's see, whatever has arisen depending on something is firstly not one with it. It's also not separate from it. So whatever has arisen depending on something is not one with it, and it's also not separate from it. So that means it's not separate and unrelated. So cause and effect are not totally unrelated and separate things. They have a relationship to each other. Like you don't get, when you plant apple seeds, you get apple trees. You don't get grape bushes or something, you know. So they are related. It's a concordant effect comes from a cause, or if you say the other way, concordant cause leads to an effect. You could, I suppose, but she didn't. Well, she might have later. I don't know. I don't, maybe when she summed it up. Okay, so then these were our... we have that idea sometimes where we don't think things are connected like that. We have this idea of, like, I can create this non-virtue and live happily ever after. We've actually done that many times. Thought that way, like, this doesn't matter. We don't, yeah, the effects of our actions have no repercussions. So then these are the major conclusions for us to remember. Any effect that arises depending on a specific cause, here you go, is not inherently separate from that cause, because if it were, then the effect could arise endlessly. Why? Because the arising of the effect wouldn't depend on the cessation of the cause. They're totally separate. In that case, too, anything could arise from anything, because nothing would have to change to produce the effect. So then, let's see, another thing was there's no discontinuation of the cause's continuum due to an effect arising from the cause, because there's still a continuum that happens, even though it might not be of a similar type. So we're not saying that when the cause's continuum becomes an effect, that there's a discontinuation. That isn't the case. There's no discontinuation, although you could have a continuation that's of a dissimilar type. And then another was, through the reasoning of dependent arising, the effect is seen neither inherently one with the cause, because then they would be the same, or inherently different from the cause, because then they would be unrelated. So this is how we get free of the defects of permanence and annihilation or discontinuation. Wow, this clock quit changing. I looked at it, it felt like 8 minutes ago, and I only moved 1 minute.
That's funny, because we think of things as not changing, clock is a useless change.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, that's right. Oh, we made it. Yeah. Yeah, the effect becomes a cause, the effect becomes a cause. It's the mutual dependence.
That's the continuity.
Yeah, it's the mutual dependence. I would say.
It's continually giving rise to another effect.
Right. And it could be of a different, dissimilar type.
Yeah.
Which then becomes a cause for a future effect.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's happening moment by moment. Yeah, I don't know how to answer that, because you can a moment, by our definition, could be defined at any amount of time. So you could say it was dependent on how you were defining it in your when you state the question. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And then what instrument you had, or like visually, we can. I used to show movies in 35 millimeter, so. So many frames go through, and they all look like it's smooth till the films get really old, which I showed a lot of ones that broke a lot, and it's like, you know. So it's, you know, but if you actually had vision that could see each of those frames, you know, you'd know they were discontinue. You know they were separate frames, you know, so it. But if you split that moment even smaller, then you couldn't. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's how you, to me, it's how you would break up the moment, which is however you set it.
Yeah, but also if things are arising, body disintegrating, and that's, if you call that a moment, then that is something that's imperceptible by our senses.
Yeah. That would be pretty hard.
Yeah.
In fact,
there is no unit. I mean, it's a flow, and yeah. There is no unit. And any little.
Yeah, that's the problem.
Here
again, right? Yeah, here again, we're back to that problem of trying to find even that the moment, and we're trying to freeze something there in our freeze frame. You know, that's how I really think that we think of things, because we can imagine a wheel rolling continuously, but when we break things down to these little things, I still think we freeze things in between each of these. You know, it's this, it's this, it's this, it's this. We can't seem to go, it's... You know what I mean?
We won't let go of that bigger idea that things are frozen.
Yeah, I find that...
Right, but I'm not talking about the frozen, I'm talking about the continuity that gives rise to the effect. That's what I'm trying to track.
Yeah, but the way you ask the question makes it sound like you're freeze-framing it in that smallest amount of time. That's what brings him to that point.
In the next chapter, there's a whole thing about how it is that we label it as continuity.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, okay.
Okay. Yeah.
So we're talking a little bit about like physical continuity, you know, like the paper or something.
Mm-hmm.
And we live in a world of bunches of those overlapping. I mean, if this building burnt, that paper and this rug would be the same ash. And if something sprouted from it, it may have some of those same molecules.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about cause and effect, nothing ever has one cause. It's all
myriad causes.
It's big. You could never understand, even in the physical realm.
Yeah, definitely. And that's why when we do the meditation on dependent arising, that's why what you're trying to do is like, you know, you have to, like, it's a network of uncountable. I mean, you actually can't trace it back, you know? I mean, it's how Thich Nhat Hanh says it is absolutely the case, you know, like the sun is in this paper, you know, that whole thing of the trees and the... And then in the book, the Lam Rim book, I've been doing little motivations each morning from His Holiness is saying that we're made out of the particles from before the Big Bang or something. You know? Why not?
And I remember this vividly, it's been over Pinhead's used a few times, but Tensor Tech Chuck used her as the example in this very point, saying it can validly be said that everything in the universe is a cause for being.
Yeah, and that's what Thich Nhat Hanh says too, yeah. That's why he has the idea of interbeing. Yeah. You can actually easily. It's not too hard to get to that, and kids can be taught this too. I know when I was in that time I went to Emory, they taught kids dependent arising who were in elementary school. They had no trouble getting it at all. They talked about it in terms of the sweater he was wearing, and all the things that went into making that sweater. You know, the sheep, and then the food that the sheep ate, and the sun, and you know, pretty soon you had everything in the universe into his sweater. Cool. Okay. Were there any questions? Oh, okay. Good. Saved. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends. May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous action spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lobsang's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase.